The media so wishes they could have the popularity that the president and the troops abroad enjoyed. And today's response to key portions referring to the troops and the purposes for being there, they will feel, I'm sure, compelled, if they cannot destroy a new hero, namely the collective heroism of America's silent majority finally getting their way for a change, Congress, united on the principle of getting behind our troops in the Gulf, the troops themselves, a president who stuck to his guns and is doing it the right way, and even the wives of the generals who received not just perfunctory but overwhelming applause, that's just killing the media. And if they cannot butcher it, demean it, pick it apart, they will quickly try to find a substitute hero while they get ludicrously gushy over Peter Arnett. They must have one of their own worshipped above all beings on this earth. And Saddam Hussein, I would remind you, not only is he like Adolf Hitler in his beginnings, his ideology, his methods, his megalomania, like Adolf Hitler, he's a consummate actor. And he has found a world stage. I mean, if he could have died and been resurrected and died painfully, knowing the resurrection would come, and in his impeccable suit to show off he can be Beverly Hills cafe style, outlasting them all. If he had known he would command the world stage, he would have died of pain. He'd let himself be crucified if he could resurrect to what's happening to him right now. And then we're supposed to weep and get chills and rosy glowed and applaud because Peter Arnett has covered wars for 30 years and he's sick of war. Well, go home to Boston. Or better yet, I still hear the echoes of peace, whatever the price. The chilling thing is that one who has poured out such sadism and brutality could strut his stuff so calmly . One whose teenage, I hate to call them his boys, but he's brainwashed them for 20 years. His teenage boys by the hundreds of thousands lice infected, eating one meal a day, covered with scabs and sores, under a continuous rain down of bombs made necessary by his arrogant, self-serving megalomania, that he could show up so calm, impeccably dressed, made up for the occasion, and recommit their blood to his madman ambitions. At the very least, George Bush's worst enemy knew during his speech, when the ovation was given for those about whom he said no one believes in freedom more than those of our country standing for freedom there in the Persian Gulf, and I do not quote him except the believes in freedom part and the location. As the ovation filled the hall where Congress listened, no one with the close-ups on George Bush's face, his worst enemies, could doubt his genuine concern. You didn't see any of that in the consummate actor's preening of himself on the world stage, and it's like an insatiable appetite. I heard as I went out the door that he's inviting the world press to come back. I mean, he never had it so good. He's got a world stage to play act on, while he calmly sits there and discusses poison gas, while they send out a report of a prisoner of war allegedly killed by our bombing. Only if he used him as a human shield, but I doubt that story. I would be more prone to believe dead at his hands, with the blame being shoveled toward us. Bill Scherer, The Nightmare Years, 1930 to 1940. You notice I have not attacked journalism. Give me some journalism, I applaud. I attack the media that calls itself journalists, who have abdicated to the same egomania of seeing themselves supreme that controls Saddam Hussein. At the Nuremberg rallies, when Hitler roared through the streets celebrating his newly won domination of Germany, William Scherer was there in Munich. As Chamberlain abandoned the Czechs, Scherer was there. In Vienna, during the night of the Anschluss, in Berlin, when Hitler loosed his Blitzkrieg on Poland, thus beginning World War II, William Scherer was there. If ever a journalist was in the right place at the right time, it was William Scherer. Initially as a newspaper man and then as one of the first overseas radio correspondents, Scherer was everywhere it mattered in the 30s and 40s. The prize-winning author provides in this, the second volume of his memoirs, an eyewitness and intensely personal vision of the crucible out of which the Nazi monster appeared. Fluent in German, married to a Viennese, Scherer had an uncanny sense of the shaping of events and sources that enabled him to act on his intuition. And as you will see, the pioneer journalist on radio who probably brought as shocking an immediacy for its day in the use of radio in this war as satellite television is taking that leap even further into immediacy in this war. But he didn't sell his soul out for the scoop. And on the scene, by analogy, he took sides with justice and right and truth, and would not simply, to keep his placement, report propaganda as though it were news. He met, knew, talked to, and occasionally drank with Goring, Goebbels, Himmler, Hess, Heydrich, Ribbentrop, Eichmann, and dozens of high command staff officers. Even Hitler he observed at first hand, close enough, he noted, to kill him. Through articles, simultaneous translations of Hitler's speeches, and his own broadcasts, Scherer desperately tried to warn the Western world. Maybe I should say that again. Through articles, simultaneous translations of Hitler's speeches, and his own broadcasts, Scherer desperately tried to warn the Western world of this demonic scourge. That's taking sides. And, you know, I'm a history major, undergraduate major, turning to philosophy and religion and education for my doctorate at Stanford, but undergraduate major in history. And like most who've studied history, I assume everybody knows it like they know their own family. We hear a lot about analogies between Chamberlain and Munich, and the concessions made in the name of a peace with honor while confronting Adolf Hitler's megalomania. And I assume, as I think others who lived through those days or have studied history, that everybody knows all about it. You know the analogy. What Chamberlain did. Some people don't know who Chamberlain is. They may think it's a male chambermaid or something. So tonight, I've decided to take the time to give us a little history lesson through the eyes and pen of a journalist, a true journalist. And maybe, against that backdrop, you can find a few more words to hurl in your ongoing letter writing and speech making, and you can cry out, give us some journalism. Like Edward R. Murrow, the associate of Bill Scherer, in the early radio days, who were journalists, who could objectively report the news but also sift it, and take from the control of the editorial desk for the first time in the history of journalism, the on-the-spot radio live coverage, bypassing the editorial desk because they were journalists enough to do some self-editing. And they knew the difference between truth and propaganda. You know, it's easy to believe that news reporting has been as it is now and always been that way, huh? Three times America has been called to lead the world against a major threat to civilization and freedom. This is the third time. The second time was the Second World War. And news reporting was far different than it is now. I'm reading from Nightmare Years by William L. Scherer. I'm reading from chapter 12, the events preceding the end of Austria, to be followed by Czechoslovakia. The exciting prospect, he says, Ed Murrow had held out of our... I want to read this because you can contrast it with the instantaneous satellite broadcasting we have today and realize how recent it really is in historic perspective. The exciting prospect Ed Murrow had held out of our steering radio into serious broadcasting of the news. I'll read that again. Because this reads like a journal. The exciting prospect Ed Murrow had held out of our steering radio into serious broadcasting of the news, at least from Europe, was soon dashed. How quickly the media forgets the pit from which they were dug. After a week of conferring with him in London at the beginning of October, I confided to my diary. Now, this is a breakthrough in broadcasting the news, 1937 to 1938. Hell, I was 8 and 9 years old. I remember it distinctly. I was full grown. After a week of conferring with him in London, at the beginning of October, I confided to my diary, quote, "One disappointing thing about the job, though, Murrow and I are not supposed to do any talking on the radio ourselves. To ignore history is to forever repeat the same mistakes. New York wants us to hire newspaper correspondents for that. We just arrange broadcasts. Since I know as much about Europe as most newspaper correspondents and a bit more than the younger ones who lack foreign languages and background, I don't get the point." The newsmen have always griped. "The point CBS made," Murrow said, "was that for us to do the reporting ourselves on the air would commit CBS editorially. Commit the network to what? It made no sense to me. So much for radio journalism. The idiocy of it staggered me. I felt let down by Murrow and the CBS brass led by William S. Paley. And I had thought, Murrow had told me, I'd been hired because of my knowledge and experience of Europe as a veteran foreign correspondent. But since I'd been jobless and broke with a new addition to the family coming, I swallowed my bitter disappointment." Even newsmen have to face reality sometimes. Old-fashioned journalists did, at least. "I would stay on with this frustrating radio job until I could get back to newspaper reporting. Murrow himself, I quickly learned, would be a grand guy to work with. He was sensitive, serious, intelligent, with a warmth behind his reserve and a droll sense of humor. We laughed about concocting a title for me that would impress the state-owned European broadcasting companies whose facilities we would need, and came up with, quote, Continental Representative of CBS. Skipping along, in quick trips to Berlin and Rome, I succeeded in breaking NBC's monopoly arrangements that had denied CBS broadcasting facilities from Germany and the Vatican. Great dedication to the public's need to know. going at it competitively. Through Dr. Goebbels, who ran the state-owned Reich Broadcasting Company, or rather, though Dr. Goebbels, who ran the state-owned Reich Broadcasting Company, was not exactly pleased at my return, even for a few days. He thought I'd been gotten rid of for good. I'm well into this book. He approved a new arrangement. The arrangement was to locate him there for CBS. In the face of foreign hostility and boycotts, it meant that another major American radio network would be broadcasting from Berlin. Breaking NBC's stranglehold on broadcast from the Vatican had proved a little more difficult. It took only a day or two to strike a bargain with the Monsignor or Monsignori who ran Vatican Radio. All they wanted was an initial lump payment of a few thousand lire, a few hundred dollars at the current rate of exchange, plus a modest annual contribution to their well-being. Like all the other foreign correspondents, I had had a paid tipster in the Vatican when I worked as a newspaper man in Rome. That's the way it was in the Eternal City, but Bill Paley in New York objected. It smacked of a bribe, he said. CBS would never pay anyone a bribe. It took some days before I could get him to accept the facts of life in Rome. Just some days. Skipping on to his move to Vienna, where his wife's homeland. It was obvious those first months of our return to Vienna that beneath the drab surface of life there was a ferment that threatened to stir up not only Austria but Europe. A good correspondent ought to be reporting it, but CBS policy forbade it. Paley and the rest of the brass in New York simply would not listen to the pleas of Ed Murrow and me to broadcast the news ourselves. It galled me to have to keep hiring newspaper correspondents to do it. Somebody needs to say to him, "You've come a long way, baby. You need to sit down and analyze if you're going the right direction." Saturday, February 5th. The news from Berlin burst upon us. Hitler had the night before cashiered the two men who had built up the German army from scratch. Shades of Saddam Hussein, not a military man, who made himself commander. Field Marshal Werner von Blumberg, Minister of War and Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, and General Freiherr Werner von Fritsch, Commander-in-Chief of the Army, the Fuhrer, a corporal in the Great War, a corporal, named himself Supreme Commander of the Armed Services. The Ministry of War was abolished. Instead, Hitler set up a high command of the armed forces of which he was the supreme commander. The next few pages talk of the house cleaning and the evolution of the Third Reich as Hitler cleaned out those that opposed him in any way, any manner, including fraudulent and faked sex charges on some of his highest commanders, and having taken charge as his student who studied him well, at least through Michael or Michelle Aflock, the ideologue who put Saddam Hussein in charge of internal security that accelerated his rise to power. Hitler cleaned house until he was supreme overall, at least in the immediate scenario. seeing what was coming and the end of Austria, Schreer begins to talk about his efforts to get CBS to still let him report on the spot. Perhaps, I thought, he said, I could interest CBS in the end of Austria. Its conquest would be Hitler's greatest triumph yet. I ask for 15 minutes of airtime to report on it. No interest. I'd obtained a lot of inside information about the horrendous meeting of the two chancellors at Berchtesgaden that, so far as I knew, had not been published or broadcast. Nothing doing. I was told to continue to present my children's choirs. The next such broadcast was scheduled from Sofia on February 24th. CBS, uninterested in the news, was especially pleased that I was arranging also to present the King of Bulgaria, no less. My superior suggested I leave Vienna for the Bulgarian capital no later than February 22nd, so I'd have plenty of time to prepare for the program. I was reluctant to go. The story breaking in Vienna was really too important to leave uncovered. I had still hoped to convince the CBS brass to let me report it. Besides, our baby was due any minute. The Austrian government of Chancellor, and this is really the beginning of the breakdown that led to Munich. The Austrian government of Chancellor, and I want you to put Austria so much in the frame of reference of the way Saddam went after Kuwait. The Austrian government of Chancellor Schutznig was crumbling. The Nazis, whom Hitler had forced Schutznig to take into his cabinet, were fast undermining it. Now, the issue is not always that the current rulers are the best. It's letting a terrorist and a worse ruler take advantage of such a scenario to excuse his evil appetite to just gobble up. The Nazis whom Hitler had forced Schutznig to take into his cabinet were fast undermining it. Nazi mobs in the streets, encouraged by release from prison of their leaders and the legalization of their party, were on the rampage. On February 24th, while I was doing my childish broadcast from Sofia, Schutznig, I learned, had attempted to answer in the Austrian Bundestag the boastful speech by Hitler to the German Reichstag of 4 days before, on that gloomy Sunday, February 20th, in Vienna. Tess, his wife, and I had sat glumly around the radio and listened to the Führer's latest outburst. He had warned that Germany would now know how to protect the 10 million Arabs living within its border. To protect the 10 million Germans living on its borders, 7 million in Austria and 3 million in Czechoslovakia. Everyone knew what Hitler meant by protect. Schutznig's speech had been conciliatory to the Germans, but he declared that Austria had gone to the limit of concessions, where we must call a halt, he said, and say this for and no further. Austria, he concluded, would never voluntarily give up its independence, and he ended with a stirring call, red, white, red, Austrian national colors, until we're dead. And the expression rhymes in also in German. The Austrian chancellor's speech set off a wild reaction in the provincial city of Graz, where 20,000 crazed Austrian Nazis invaded the town square, tore down the loudspeakers carrying Schutznig's words, hauled down the Austrian flag, and raised the swastika banner of Germany. With the Austrian Nazi Seyss Inquart, whom Hitler had forced Schutznig to make Minister of Interior, in charge of the police, no effort was made to curb this Nazi riot or others which began to break out throughout Austria. Desperation, Schutznig turned for help to the Austrian workers, whose free trade unions and political party, the Social Democrats, he'd kept suppressed. But it was too late. Still, Schutznig made one last effort to save Austria from Hitler and the Nazis. In a speech at Innsbruck on the evening of March 9th, he announced that a plebiscite would be held in Austria 4 days hence. on Sunday, March 13th. The Austrian people would be asked whether they were for a free, independent, social, Christian, and united Austria. Scherer says, I missed this sudden and fateful announcement. That evening I was on the overnight train to Ljubljana, the charming little capital of Slovenia in Yugoslavia, to do still another children's broadcast for Columbia's American School of the Air. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
It gets better. I still have been unable to interest anyone at CBS in letting me report it firsthand on the fate of Austria. Ed Murrow had left London for Warsaw to arrange for a juvenile chorus to sing on this confounded School of the Air. He tells a few more little personal things, and he's in a taxi, and he says, the taxi driver abruptly brought me down to earth. He was reflecting on something. Overhead, two planes were dropping leaflets. What are they all about? I asked him, plebiscite. He had just returned home, having been out of town. What plebiscite? The one Schuschnigg ordered for Sunday. I climbed the stairs to our apartment, puzzled, asked the maid. She handed me a stack of newspapers for the 3 days I'd been away. The front page headlines brought me up to date. Schuschnigg had called a plebiscite for Sunday. There was no mention of Hitler's reaction in the Vienna newspapers. He goes to see his wife in the hospital, then catches a taxi to Schwarzenberg Cafe to catch up on the news, where other newsmen were present. Fodor, the Vienna correspondent for the Manchester Guardian and the New York Post and a walking encyclopedia of information about Austria, was there. Others also. They were still tense but hopeful. Even Fodor, who was a Jew, or as a Jew, had to fear for his life if the Nazis took over. The plebiscite would go off peaceably, he thought. Schuschnigg should win it easily now that he apparently had gained the support of the socialists. That would be a blow to Hitler. Fodor made a special point of that. I felt better, he said. A few more personal comments. Planned in his own mind what he would point out in a broadcast if CBS gave me access to the radio. He sent a cable to the news director in New York, urging him to allow him to broadcast the results of the plebiscite. But before he could telephone it in, or he'd wrote out a cable, before he could telephone it in, events on this Friday begin to cascade. Around 4 p.m., as I crossed the Karlsplatz to catch the subway, I was stopped by a crowd of about 1,000 people. Most of them wore Nazi swastika armbands on the right sleeve of their overcoats, but they were surprisingly docile, and I would suggest that the king and his brother of Jordan read this, because the Nazis screaming in Austria can only be analogized to the Palestinians screaming in Jordan with more loyalty to Hussein, Saddam Hussein, than they do have to Jordan's king, Hussein. And at any moment, this is the tightrope he's walking in Jordan with that mob of Palestinians screaming with glee when they hear a Scud missile is landing in Israel. As I crossed the Karlsplatz to catch the subway, I was stopped by a crowd of about 1,000 people. Most of them wore Nazi swastika armbands on the right sleeve of their overcoats. Most of them carried pictures of Saddam, screaming PLO slogans. But they were surprisingly docile. One lone policeman was yelling and gesticulating at them, and they were giving ground. If that's all the guts the Austrian Nazis have, I thought, Schuschnigg will have no trouble with his plebiscite. I hurried on to the hospital. See my wife. The baby was fine. Reassured, I headed back to town.
When I emerged from the subway at Karlsplatz about 6 p.m., I was amazed to find that the situation there had abruptly changed. A mob of several thousand shouting, hysterical Palestinians were milling around the... Hysterical Nazis were milling around the vast square in the gathering darkness. Are you saying that the Palestinians are Nazis? You got a good set of ears. If they're supporting Saddam Hussein, they're Nazis. Sir. Not all of these Nazis in the streets, and not all of the brown shirts, and not all of the Hitler Youth Movement understood the philosophy. Didn't matter. They supported Hitler. The outcome was the same. You support Saddam Hussein, you're supporting a Nazi. That makes you a Nazi to me. You got it. You heard me right. A mob of several thousand shouting, hysterical Nazis. You say, well, don't the Palestinians have some needs? Yeah, these Nazis. And when we get to Czechoslovakia, the Germans in Czechoslovakia had some needs. But Hitler wasn't the answer to their needs. I'm quite sure there are a few people that need some bread, but robbing the corner grocery store and beating up the owner isn't the way to do it. I'm quite sure there are a few men in Los Angeles tonight could use some sex, but raping the next girl you see isn't the answer. Or boy. I mean, if you're too stupid to know that you're supporting a Nazi when you support Saddam Hussein, maybe you'll be shocked into studying his history. Bad dogs run together. A mob of several thousand shouting, hysterical Nazis. You know, you never have too much trouble figuring out what I mean. So you can just assume that when I say it, that's what I mean. Hysterical Nazis was milling around the vast square in the gathering darkness. The lone policeman of 2 hours ago must have been captured by the crowd or gone home for supper, and I found myself being swept by this riotous, yelling throng out of the square, past the ring, past the opera, into the Kärntnerstrasse, and down the narrow street where most of the fashionable shops were to the offices of the German, quote, tourist bureau, which with its immense flower-draped portrait of Saddam Hussein in the window, with its immense flower-draped portrait of Adolf Hitler in the window, had been a rallying point, a veritable shrine for the Austrian Nazis. Well, tell me about your problems when you're carrying Saddam Hussein around, bound at his picture. Don't tell me you're a law-abiding citizen if you're carrying Al Capone's picture around and saying this is citizenship. Don't sit in a courtroom and look with sad eyes and sympathy at the Midnight Strangler or whatever that stupid jerk with his demon signs was and tell me that you're just a charitable Christian. You want me to quit? Saddam learned. I've told you over and over. Michel Aflaq, the ideologue, was a profound student of Hitler, his successes, and why his success could not be perpetuated as he viewed success. Saddam Hussein has built the Ba'ath Party and his entire goals and programs of Iraq on this proof coin pattern that he adopted. And I'm going to show you the path to war and why it was so hard to stop Hitler. And I wish somebody would count up the number of lives that were lost in the Second World War and then estimate the casualties we will face in this one and have faced these 12 days alongside the first 12 days of the Second World War. Maybe you'll get your history in perspective. Now, if you want me to continue, get on the telephone. Madison, Connecticut. I know this is off the subject, but I can't get over the beauty of those horses, the freedom they exhibit at play. I just love them. I appreciate it when you tell me you appreciate the horses. A lot of effort goes into providing that programming of on-site videotapes of the various places across this country that we reach. And the horses that represent the University Network equestrian team in their training and in their off-season relaxation time that they're having right now and getting ready for the show season that's coming up. We made a deliberate choice some time back in our continued attempts to keep someone from making the mistake of putting us in the box as a specimen of that species called television evangelists, which we're not. We deliberately made the decision to do the programming the way we do it. When I'm waiting for your calls, we couldn't obtain a football or a basketball franchise, but we could build a worldwide competitive equestrian team, and we did it.
Sir.
And it is an international sport, and we're going international.
Yes.
We decided we wouldn't do little Christian soap operas for you and do 2 weeks old Christian news reporting on tape. I'd just soon sit and do the Mean Gene review on the news as it came out during the day.
Yes.
We decided we didn't want singers who couldn't make it in the real world who got converted so they could be on the religious circuit. And we decided we'd play the best of music, wide variety, and show the most beautiful living creation God ever made, horses. And that's our programming surrounding me. Just me and the horses, music and you. So I appreciate it when you tell me you like them. Marshall, Texas. Tell Doc I usually watch on Sunday, but my husband went out and bought me a shortwave radio today, and now I can listen every night. I've been telling you that. Baltimore, Maryland. Absolutely the best program I've ever seen. I agree with him. I believe he's reading my mind. I didn't know he was on shortwave. I have two shortwave radios. Is it 9785 megahertz? 31-meter band. The answer is yes. I'm reading from The Nightmare Years by William L. Scherer. He's married to a Viennese lady. They've just had a newborn baby. He's assigned to Europe with Ed Murrow and the fledgling CBS radio network headed by Bill Paley, New York Brass. They're not allowed to talk on the radio and report news because it would take editorial control away. And he tells of his difficulties of being able to report it, though he's on the scene in Hitler's takeover of Austria that preceded Czechoslovakia and the peacemaking efforts of Chamberlain at Munich, which is what caused so many of our representatives in Congress on a bipartisan basis who were old enough to remember. To compare any further waiting on Saddam to the Munich choice. As I said earlier, I assume everybody knows this history, but just in case. Schuschnigg is the Chancellor of Austria. Nazi mobs in Austria are acting up. More analogous, in a sense, because we're seeing it, to the Palestinians acting up in Jordan. But we didn't see what was going on in Kuwait. It only came to our attention after the takeover. Schusnigged, in a last-ditch effort to stave off Hitler's threats to, quote, protect the German citizens in Austria, had scheduled a plebiscite, a vote on independence. Schreer is downtown. He says, I found myself being swept by a riotous yelling throng out of the square, past the ring, past the opera, into the Kärntnerstrasse and down this narrow street where most of the fashionable shops were, the offices of the German, quote, tourist bureau, which with its immense flower-draped portrait of Adolf Hitler in the window, raise any similarities with Saddam spell Hussein? You know, you spell Saddam backwards, it's mad ass. With its immense flower-draped portrait of Adolf Hitler in the window, had been a rallying point, a veritable shrine for the Austrian Nazis. I spent a week now in Republic of Fear and in other comments showing the source of the philosophy that has built Iraq with the world paying no attention to its present threatening stance. Michel Aflaq, the Syrian, studied Adolf Hitler and Mussolini and the revolution in Russia. He was the ideologue, everyone agrees, behind the Ba'ath Party. Saddam was appointed to him by him, or recommended by him, to head internal security. And on that ideologue of Nazi Germany, with some Saddam corrections, he built the present Iraq. You'll see the similarities. Here the mob stopped to demonstrate, and in the streetlights I noted the faces of some of the individuals who made up this churning herd. A familiar sight it was to an old veteran of Nazi Germany. I had seen those faces at the party rallies in Nuremberg, the fanatical popping eyes, the gaping mouths, the contorted expressions of hysteria and paranoia, and now they were screaming, Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil! Heil Hitler! Heil Hitler! Hang Schusnigg, hang Schusnigg, ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer. The people, the state, the Führer. The brown shirts at Nuremberg had never bellowed the Nazi slogans with such mania. Saddam, Saddam, hang Bush, hang Bush. Any similarities? I'd offer the popping, fanatical popping eyes, the gaping mouths, the contorted expressions of hysteria. I'd often seen the Vienna police break up Nazi demonstrations in this spot, but now they were standing with folded arms. And most of them were grinning. Some of the young women in the crowd began to take off their hook cross armbands and tie them on the sleeves of the police. Obviously, the Vienna police were going over to the Nazis. I wonder what the hell had happened so suddenly. I turned to some of those nearest to me. They were too excited to answer. Finally, a middle-aged woman responded, the plebiscite. She yelled in my ear, called off. We think Hitler comes tomorrow. Isn't it wonderful? That's exactly what the Palestinians would say if he were to march into Jordan. Too bad the idiot little king doesn't understand that. The calling off of the plebiscite was news to me. If true, I thought Schusnigg could scarcely survive this very night. He was already losing the streets and the police to the Nazis. I extricated myself from the swirling mob, fought my way back to the Hotel Bristol. Ed Taylor, another newsman, was in the lobby. He confirmed the news. Schusnigg had called off his plebiscite. He had promised to broadcast an explanation shortly. Ed and I caught a taxi to the American legation. John Wiley was standing before his desk, clutching his long cigarette holder and trying to smile in the way one does after a terrible setback. It's all over, my friends, he said quietly. there has been an ultimatum from Baghdad. There's been an ultimatum from Berlin. No plebiscite Sunday or the German army marches in. Schuschnigg capitulated. Wiley advised us to keep the radio on. The chancellor might go on the air at any minute and explain the situation. I had to get hold of Morrow in Poland and enlist his aid and get New York to let me broadcast. I returned to our apartment, put in a long-distance call to Ed, switched on the radio. It was playing a gay Strauss waltz. I couldn't reach Ed. I hung up. The waltz abruptly stopped. "Attention, attention," an excited voice said. "In a few minutes, you'll hear an important announcement." Then came the familiar ticking of the metronome, the Austrian radio's identification signal. Maddening, it sounded. Tick, tick, tick. I turned it down. Then a voice I knew well. It was Chancellor Schuschnigg, Chancellor of Austria. I took down his words, quote, "This day has placed us in a tragic and decisive situation. I have to give my Austrian fellow countrymen the details of the events today. The German government today handed to President Miklas an ultimatum with a time limit, ordering him to nominate as chancellor a person designated by the German government and to appoint members of a cabinet on the orders of the German government. Otherwise, German troops would invade Austria. I declare before the world that the reports launched in Germany concerning disorders by the workers, the shedding of streams of blood, and the creation of a situation beyond the control of the Austrian government are lies from A to Z. President Miklas has asked me to tell the people of Austria that we have yielded to force, since we are not prepared, even in this terrible situation, to shed blood. We have decided to order the troops to offer no resistance. So I take leave of the Austrian people with a German word of farewell uttered from the depth of my heart. God protect Austria." End of Chancellor Schuschnigg's words. Toward the end, I thought his voice would break, that he would begin to sob, but he managed to control himself to the end. There was a moment of silence as his voice fell away, then the Austrian national anthem was played. It sounded as if it came off of an old record. It was the familiar tune of Deutschland über alles, only in the original and slightly different version as Haydn composed it. That was all. A little later, the rasping voice of the Judas came over the air. This was Dr. Arthur Seiss Inquart, an early friend of Schuschnigg. He sounded confused, but he made one important point. The Austrian army, he said, was to offer no resistance. This was the first I'd heard of a German invasion, Hitler's ultimatum. Schuschnigg, it said, was capitulate or face invasion. Hitler had immediately broken the terms of his own ultimatum. They capitulated and he still invaded. He now had his Anschluss, the union of his native Austria with Germany. He might also have, it occurred to me, a war. This was the last time the old allies, Britain, France, and Italy, assisted by Czechoslovakia, which had a well-armed military force, could act to stop Hitler. To still give you a little of the frustration and how news reporting has changed, at any rate, on the spot in Vienna, I had the most important story of my life, and I had it to myself so far as reporting firsthand on American radio was concerned. My sole rival, Max Jordan of NBC, was not there. My main problem was to get it on the air. First, I had to convince CBS to put me on. Then I had to have facilities for the broadcast from whoever was in charge of RAVAG, R-A-V-A-G, the Austrian Broadcasting Company. I'd need a studio, a microphone, a telephone line to a shortwave transmitter, preferably in Geneva, Switzerland, or London, where there would be no Nazi censorship. He wanted to get the story out without Nazi censorship. But I would take a Berlin transmitter if I had to and take a chance on getting the main story past the censor. Well, I told you when I started this, you haven't heard me put down journalism. Just the current media that have departed from journalism. He goes on through two pages trying to get his story out. He couldn't get it out. No lines, no broadcast. Austrian broadcasting house, battle to get by the guards. Scarface trooper didn't greet him warmly. You back, nothing doing, no lines, no broadcast, please leave. He beckoned a couple of stormtroopers, one of whom took my arm none too gently and ushered me to the street. Tried once more to get in the building, no admittance, get along with you. I walked home across the Karlsplatz, it was 3 a.m., I'd failed. Headed home. Got to his apartment, the phone rang, it was Ed Murrow. I told him the news, my bad news. Fly to London tomorrow, why don't you? We can get in by tomorrow evening and give us the first uncensored eyewitness account, and I'll come down to Vienna. Phoned the airport, then went to sleep. Next day, March 12, 1938, I struggled to get to London. When I arrived at the airport at 7 a.m., I found the German Gestapo had taken over the main building. A surly, black-coated SS officer shouted at me that no planes were being allowed to take off. I soon found that actually Goering's Luftwaffe was running the airport. Military planes were landing every minute. Hitler banned all commercial flights from Berlin. While waiting for takeoff, I ran into an Austrian police official. He wasn't happy about being bossed around. With that informant, he found out a little of what had happened to Schuschnigg and continued to try to get out. At Tempelhof Airport in Berlin, he made for the offices of the Dutch airline. They had a plane leaving in an hour for Amsterdam on to London, had one more seat. I instantly bought it. There was time for lunch and a glance at Berlin's morning newspapers. I was taken aback by the headlines, especially in Hitler's own newspaper, the Völkische Beobachter. Across the front page, a banner line in 3-inch high type: Kuwait saved by Saddam. German dash Austria saved from chaos. Beneath was an incredible story. A tissue of lies, no doubt concocted by Propaganda Minister Goebbels, describing violent red disorders in the main street of Vienna, fighting, shooting, pillage, it said. You notice right off, he didn't have any trouble distinguishing between lies and truth. He's trying to get a story of truth out. He's not going to call CBS headquarters and say, I have an SS trooper at my side, and I'm reporting on the happenings in Austria. German Austria saved from chaos. Then every hour on the hour, our radio correspondent William Scherer in Vienna reports live from the scene. Of course, approved by the censor at his side, but in the interest of getting the news out, what is the story, Peter? German Austria saved from chaos. Well, can you give me details? No, that's all we're allowed to say right now. This is Peter Arnett reporting from Vienna. March 12th. You want me to continue? Get on the telephone. To ignore history is to condemn oneself to forever repeating it. I'm reading from The Nightmare Years, William L. Schreier, who along with Edward R. Murrow pioneered live radio broadcasting in the years 1937 to 38 and the preparation for war and the steps that led up to Munich and the insatiable appetite of the madman Hitler as he was gobbling up his neighbors. You see the difference between true journalism and what we're confronting today. Technical equipment always moves ahead of cultural boundaries that sad experiences of history teach you to control. We now have weapons capable of annihilating mankind. Thank God they are still controlled by civilized people. The telephone came on the scene, developed its own culture before people were able to bend that culture to established manners. How many times have you gotten mad waiting in line to see someone courteously and someone else dials a telephone and you stand there cooling your heels while the one that didn't wait in line gets to talk? And I can give you a myriad number of samples. It's hard to believe that in 1937 and 38, the words that I'm reading in this journal-type report by Bill Schreier record the very first live reporting from a war zone about war facts on radio. TV wasn't around yet. In spite of ordering the chancellor in Austria to concede Hitler's demands or the army would invade, giving what appeared to be an alternative choice, and in spite of the fact that the plebiscite schedule was called off and the Chancellor of Austria conceded his demands, Hitler still marched in with his troops. Bill Schreier is trying to get out to give this report on CBS radio, still never having yet been allowed to give a live report because they felt it would somehow cut past and establish the editorial posture of the news and transfer it from the editors to the person talking on the radio. Waiting to get out on a Dutch airline where he had bought the last seat, he's glancing at the Berlin morning newspapers after the march into Austria. I was taken aback by the headlines, especially in Hitler's own newspaper. Across the front page, a banner line in 3-inch type. German Austria saved from chaos. Beneath was an incredible story. A tissue of lies, no doubt concocted by propaganda minister Goebbels, describing violent red disorders. Communist in the main streets of Vienna, describing fighting, shooting, pillage. It was accompanied by a DNB dispatch from Vienna saying that during the night, Seyss Inquart, the appointed Quisling Judas forced on Austria by Hitler as part of the concessions that they made to him to try to avoid what ultimately happened anyway. They claim that this Quisling had wired Hitler to send in German troops to protect Austria from bloodshed provoked by armed socialists and communists. accustomed as I was from my years in Berlin to Saddam's lies, accustomed as I was from my years in Berlin, Baghdad, to Saddam's lies. Let's start over. Accustomed as I was from my years in Berlin to Hitler's lies, I could scarcely believe that he could perpetrate such a one as this. There had been no disorders in Vienna. He was on the scene. And I doubted that even a traitor like Seyss Inquart had telegraphed Berlin saying there were and asking for German troops. Hitler and his henchmen, I was absolutely sure, had faked the telegram to justify his invasion. Footnote says this was confirmed by the secret German documents seized by the Allies at the end of World War II. But he didn't need that evidence to know truth and falsity when he saw it. That's journalism. I tucked the newspapers into my briefcase. I intended to read from them during my... during my trip. And then my broadcast from London, if I ever got there. For a moment after lunch, it looked as though I wouldn't. There was a great deal of confusion at the airport, with priority being given to German planes taking off for Vienna. Finally, when I was I'd about given up, the flight was called, and I felt relieved when we had circled over Berlin and turned west. I was at last getting free of Nazi censorship. I began to scrawl a rough script for the broadcast from London. It was almost finished by the time we landed. I phoned the office from the airfield. To my happy surprise, the English secretary informed me that New York had arranged for me to go on the air for a 15-minute report at 11:30 that evening, 6:30 p.m. at home. This was a breakthrough. The very first time CBS had ever allowed one of its own staff to go on the air and report the news firsthand. He has a footnote here to the skeptic. So many persons who have read this section express disbelief that CBS would not up to this time, 1938, allow a veteran foreign correspondent to report on the air himself, that I feel I should cite the man who founded and ran CBS and owned most of it, William S. Paley, in his memoirs, As It Happened, page 131, writing of this period, comments, quote, Scherer's regular assignment from a base in Vienna, like Murrow's from his base in London, was to arrange broadcasts and do interviews. Neither of them at the time was really a broadcast newsman. It would have been more accurate to say that neither of us was permitted to be, quote, a broadcast newsman. Too bad Bill Paley died. And sold his stock. If you'd been doing what I told you to do these last few years, we could have bought CBS. Done an end run on Turner when he tried to do it. I just love to look at this because I have all kinds of places I imagine I'd like to put it. This was a breakthrough, the first time CBS had ever allowed one of its own staff to go on the air and report the news firsthand. I could scarcely believe it. 15 minutes at 11:30. And over the feedback from New York, heard the CBS announcer introduce me. Quote, a little more than 24 hours ago, Nazi troops passed over the border into Austria. At the time of the invasion yesterday, William L. Scherer, Columbia's Central European Director, was in Vienna. This afternoon he flew to London to bring you an uncensored eyewitness account of the move. We take you now to London. That was the first. 1938. That's why the news media does not want this war compared to the Second World War. That's why they keep coming at us and comparing it to Vietnam. There was no declaration of war in Vietnam. There is no comparison of the basic reason we were in Vietnam. North Vietnam for many decades would never threaten the world the way Saddam Hussein and Iraq can threaten the world and the way Germany threatened the world. On that cue, facing a mic in a BBC studio, I begin my first broadcast of the news since joining CBS. Next day, a Sunday, there was a more important breakthrough. Ed Murrow and I think I can say, helped radio news broadcasting abruptly come of age. We arranged and put on the air the first world news roundup ever. From that hasty development sprang the principal format of broadcast news, first over the radio, then over television, as we've known it ever since. That was the very first one on that evening of Sunday, March 13th, 1938. He then continues to tell you more and more stories of the expansion of the reporting. Then he picks up again the background of the steps that led to Chamberlain's sellout at Munich. At 4 p.m. on Monday, I broadcast a report on Prime Minister Chamberlain's statement to the Commons on Hitler's conquest. The immediacy of radio fascinated me. Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain of Britain arose to make a statement in the House of Commons half hour ago. It was still coming over the news ticker as I began to report. What Chamberlain said did not surprise me, but it disturbed me. As had a statement to the Commons on the Austrian situation he made on March 2nd. Then he had pretended that what happened at Berchtesgaden was merely that two statesmen, Hitler and Schuschnigg, had agreed upon certain measures for the improvement of relations between the two countries. In Vienna, I had read that statement with astonishment. I knew that the British legation in Vienna had provided Chamberlain with the details of Hitler's Berchtesgaden ultimatum to Schuschnigg. The Prime Minister's deceit shocked me. Now, as I read his statement over the air, I became skeptical of much that he was saying. He was telling the Commons that his new Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax, had told the new German Foreign Minister Ribbentrop in London 24 hours before Hitler's march into Austria that the British government attached the greatest importance to all measures being taken to ensure that the plebiscite in Austria was carried out without interference or intimidation from Germany. Now, Anthony Eden had resigned as Foreign Secretary in February, a week after Schuschnigg capitulated at Berchtesgaden, principally because of his opposition to further appeasement of Hitler and Mussolini by Chamberlain. So Chamberlain came into that vacuum left by Anthony Eden. He himself, Chamberlain added, had made very earnest representations in the same sense. I wondered. Footnote. After the war, in studying the captured secret papers of the Wilhelmstrasse, I came across a report of Ribbentrop's, which was sent directly to Hitler on March 10th, 2 days before he marched into Austria, saying that after talking to Chamberlain and Halifax, he, Hitler, quote, was convinced that England will do nothing in regard to Austria. Now, maybe, you won't see it played much, maybe the best interview that's been played on CNN, played yesterday of the ambassador to Bahrain, from Saudi Arabia. They ask him questions. Why? You know, the one that's occupied all day today. Why is Saddam sending his planes to Iran? He said he sends his Scud missiles to Israel because he wants to provoke Israel into the war, to make it spread further. He has no hopes of winning. He's just a troublemaker. He sends his planes to Iran, hoping and believing that that might provoke the United States to go against those planes in Iran, which the news media all day tried to provoke them into doing. I mean, they act like they've been told 1,000 times. I heard the same question 50 times. Well, if you have air superiority, why can't you shoot these planes down before they get there? They were told over and over again, we can't keep a cap. We could. We have nobody to oppose us. If that were our purpose, we could keep a cap over Iraq and shoot every plane that takes off. But the media, with their inconsistency, the minute that destroying Iraq becomes the purpose instead of delivering Kuwait, they'll be on the military like ugly on ape. And they get told over and over again, we're proceeding with our game plan. Those planes are not bothering us. If they do, we can kill them when they take off there, just as easily as taking off in Iraq. They're further away than they were in Iraq. They're no bigger threat in Iran than they were in Iraq. Why use our assets when we're bombing the Republican Guard to sit over the whole country and try to watch a plane taking off? That isn't worth much when it gets up there. I mean, the only threat they pose is kamikaze pilots, and they ain't going to get very close. It ain't like the Second World War. When you got missiles, you can shoot from another plane that'll hone in on them with radar and kill them a mile away. This Arab who knows their way says he's just trying to stir up trouble. And he's put them there because if he can provoke Israel into the war, then Iran will go to the war and the planes are there. They know what his plans are. They're not playing his game. Now, this sounds just like Saddam, who miscalculates. And he went on to say, the Arab ambassador, he continues to miscalculate. He didn't believe that America would do anything about his moving into Kuwait. He didn't believe America would go to war. Neither did Hitler. 2 days before he went into Austria, he was convinced that England would do nothing in regard to Austria. The prime minister finally got to the point of what he had to say, quoting Chamberlain again, quote, the hard fact is that nothing could have arrested what has actually happened in Austria unless this country and other countries had been prepared to use force. That was true enough, but I wondered what the future of Great Britain could be if it were unwilling to use force to counter Nazi force. He wondered it at the time. That was his point of view as a journalist who knew the Nazis. Winston Churchill, still out of power, still a lonely voice in the wilderness of British politics, touched on that subject in a speech that struck me as the most realistic and foresighted of any in the House that day. Quote, Winston Churchill. Chamberlain's the prime minister, not Churchill. He will be later. But he's in the wilderness now. The gravity of the event of March 12th cannot be exaggerated, Winston Churchill said. Europe is confronted with aggression, and there is only one choice open, either to submit like Austria or else to take effective measures while time remains. If we go on waiting upon events, how much shall we throw away of the resources now available for our security and the maintenance of peace? How many friends will be alienated? How many potential allies shall we go down one by one, down the grisly gulf? But few in Parliament were paying much attention to Churchill. His own Tory party was solidly behind Chamberlain's policy of appeasing the fascist dictators. Churchill said something else that reminded anyone who would listen of the staggering strategic victory Saddam had achieved by taking Kuwait. Churchill said something else that reminded anyone who would listen of the staggering strategic victory Hitler had achieved by taking Austria. Quote, Kuwait City is the center of the energy sources of all the countries. I'll read it his way. Vienna is the center of the communications of all the countries which formed the old Austro-Hungarian Empire and of the countries lying to the southeast in Europe. A long stretch of the Danube is now in German hands. The mastery of Vienna gives to Nazi Germany military and economic control of the whole of the communications of southeastern Europe by road, by river, and by rail. What is the effect of this on the structure of Europe? These muddle-headed peace yellows, always belittling any reason on the face of this earth for using force and standing up to evil. Oh, it really played big how dark clouds from burning oil would produce a spring cold that would produce famine around the world. There is no way on earth that Saddam Hussein would not now be in control of Saudi Arabia and all the Gulf states if we had not moved. None whatever. And with that throttle hold on the energy source of the globe, he would have perpetrated famine beyond belief. It was a crucial question, but Chamberlain didn't answer it. Some of my colleagues who had heard Churchill speak in the House told me that they'd never heard him more eloquent. It gave me an idea. Why not ask Churchill to talk over our network and speak the very eloquent words he'd use in the House of Commons? Paley, when I phoned him, liked the idea very much. Apparently he knew Churchill. Call Winston immediately, Paley said. Tell him I'd like very much for him to do a 15-minute broadcast for CBS, preferably repeating what he said so well in the House of Commons. I'll phone him at once, I said. How much do we offer him? $50, Paley said. When he finally got to Churchill, Churchill says, tell your boss I'll be happy to do it for $500, 100 pounds, that is. It was a very reasonable sum, I thought. Paley, when I called him back, refused to pay it. There's more as we move on toward Munich. You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
Get on the telephone. I got one more comment. If a preacher had been lost in an automobile in northern Arabia and they found 6,000 cash in his abandoned car, that's all we'd hear about. Night after night for the next 6 months. Do you notice how nothing's said about that? You're only supposed to carry so much cash out of the United States, you know. I feel sorry for Bob Simon. I just got to do my duty. Public has a right to know. But they ain't saying much about 6,000 cash found in the car. American cash. Been a preacher who abandoned that car and 6,000 cash in it. That's all we'd have heard every night. From the night the car was found. Paley didn't think Winston Churchill was worth $50. The price has sure gone up on modern commentators. Get on telephone. Now, I am reading from The Nightmare Years by Bill Scherer. He was the first to report live on radio in 1938 from London, having just come from Vienna and witnessed the crushing of Vienna by Hitler. He and Bill Murrell, or Edward R. Murrell, rather, Bill Scherer and Edward R. Murrell, pioneered broadcast journalism that's now grown to what we see every night on this war. As I read from this, there's a contrast between real journalism, as you see the adherence to truth, the literal soul identity with truth, that could not be abandoned in some prostitution of that dedication to simply being the first to report something, whatever the price. And at the same time, I'm illustrating the trip to Munich and the similarities between those who wanted to wait, and just keep waiting, and give Saddam another chance for peace, and peace at any cost because the price of war is too great. And I think you're smart enough to see the parallels as I've read it. For a week now, we have pointed out the true ideologue, Michel Aflaq, and the well-thought-out Nazi fascistic commitment that produced modern Iraq. It's gone on in the shadows, has not been recognized for what it was. And he miscalculated. As I preached on Sunday, I believe God saw to it. He should have waited 5 more years, and he would then have held the world at bay, or the world would have been forced to face nuclear confrontation. The only person who saw what was coming was Churchill. And when Austria was taken, reading from The Nightmare Years, William L. Scherer, he said, Vienna is the center of communications of all the countries which formed the old Austrian-Hungarian Empire and of the countries lying to the southeast in Europe. This isn't a speech. He was not the prime minister. Chamberlain was. A long stretch of the Danube is now in German hands. The mastery of Vienna gives to Nazi Germany military and economic control of the whole of the communications of southeastern Europe by road, by river, and by rail. What is the effect of this on the structure of Europe? And there were those that would say, no blood for communications. Scherer left London at the end of that hectic week, depressed. This is the true journalist who knows the difference between truth and lies and who cares. Depressed that Hitler had gotten away again with aggression and that the British and the French had been so pusillanimous about it. No one in London except Churchill seemed to realize the significance of what had happened. That the Anschluss, or the swallowing up of Austria and treating Germany and Austria as one, was just another step for Hitler toward domination of Europe. Chamberlain, at the end of his speech to the House, had announced that the government would review its rearmament program in the light of events. It would review Germany's rearmament program in light of the events of swallowing up Austria. What a paltry response to the German dictator. And they say, well, we helped Saddam rearm. Well, so did they help Germany rearm. Because you've made mistakes, and letting a cobra in your house doesn't mean you don't cut its head off because of the mistake. As my plane lifted off from Croydon, my lagging spirits began to revive. He was going to see Murrow, and on a personal and professional level, my whole life and work had been changed in the course of this dramatic week. I hated to admit it, but Hitler was mainly responsible for that. The Anschluss had overnight smashed all the barriers that had kept Murrow and me off the air. And what Ed and I had achieved was even more significant as its breakthrough. We had put together the first broadcast news roundup. From now on, millions of people would get their evening news that way, news that would not be in the newspapers until the following morning. That's how recent this reporting system is. 1938. Murrow met me that evening at the Aspern Airport. It was too late to gain admission to the hospital to see how Tess, his wife, was, who had just given birth to their baby. But Ed had just come from there and assured me that though Tess was still having a rough time, she would certainly pull through. It had been difficult in the confusion of the Nazi takeover. One Jewish woman across the hall from Tess had jumped out the window and killed herself and her baby. Others had fled. Tess's obstetrician had not yet returned, but another doctor had been found. When Ed and I arrived before my house in the Plossgasse, SS guards in steel helmets with fixed bayonets were standing at the door. What looked like a whole platoon of them stood guard before the Rothschild Palace next to us. When we started to enter my home, the SS men prodded us back. "I live here," I said. "Makes no difference. You can't go in," one of the guards countered. "We've taken over Kuwait." I tried to curb my rage. I'd had so much experience with these Nazi roughnecks in Germany. "Where can I find your commander?" I asked. "In the Rothschild Palace." A towering SS man escorted us into the gardener's house, which adjoined our building and where Louis Rothschild had resided the last year. It was a big house, actually. As we entered, we collided with some SS officers who were carting up silver and other loot from the basement. One who appeared to be the commander of the unit was loaded down with a heavy box of silver knives and forks. He put them down, not the least embarrassed, while I explained my business and our nationality. It struck him as rather funny, but he told the guard to escort us to my door. "But you'll have to stay put there, at least for a while," he said, again chuckling, "until this little operation is finished." From the window of my apartment, Ed and I, after a stiff drink, watched the Iraqi soldiers emerging from the houses in Kuwait City and piling their booty in waiting trucks. Watched the SS men emerging from the Rothschild house and piling their booty in waiting trucks. I was anxious to see what Kuwait City, now that Saddam had taken over, looked like. So we crept, you figure out when to put what in. So we crept down the stairs, waited until our guards were away from the entryway, and sneaked out on tiptoe in the darkness. The streets were fairly quiet. Ed said all the Jews had pretty well been rounded up and arrested, several thousand of them, as well as several more thousand socialists and followers of Schuschnigg. The former chancellor himself, Ed said, was under Gestapo arrest, but no one knew exactly where. Some more reporting on the terrible days. And then he reports on March 15th. The greatest moment of all for Hitler came on March 15th. When standing on the balcony of the Hofburg Palace in Vienna, from which the Habsburg kings and emperors once had ruled, he shouted at the immense crowds assembled below, quote, "As the Führer and Chancellor of the German nation and the Reich, I now declare before history the incorporation of my native land into the German Reich." 2 days before, at Linz, the day on which Schuschnigg's plebiscite was to have been held, Hitler had promulgated a so-called Anschluss law proclaiming the end of Austria. Kuwait, it began, is a province of the state of Iraq, because he said it was. This is what Hitler said. Austria is a province of the German Reich. Those who have studied Saddam say and readily admit he's not an innovator. He's a student and has perfected the application of fascism and the promulgation of his persona beyond where Hitler took his. He learned from Hitler. Then Bill Scherer began to broadcast. I'll skip over how it came about. Now that I was free to broadcast and could do some serious reporting. There's a little background. Austria, province of the German Reich, then with customary deceit having taken over, he ordered a free and secret plebiscite on which German Austrians would decide on the union of their country with Germany. As I read to you last week, you are an Arab by Saddam's definition if you agree with the Revolutionary Control Council, with him. You are not defined by genes or birth. You are defined as an Arab by agreeing with him. And seeing this happen, now that I was free to broadcast and could do some serious reporting, I covered the phony plebiscite. As if the people of Germany and Austria could really decide on the Anschluss, Hitler stormed up and down the length of Germany and Austria, making bombastic political speeches, exhorting the populace to vote ja. As if Schuschnigg were still a political opponent, he heaped scorn and ridicule on the fallen, evil, self-indulgent ruling family of Kuwait. Can you do the fill-ins from now on so I can just read? Yes, he heaps scorn and ridicule on the fallen, imprisoned Austrian chancellor. Schuschnigg, he kept reiterating, had double-crossed him by promising him if he would turn the 3,000 guests, hostages, loose. Schuschnigg, he kept reiterating, had double-crossed him by his election forgery. I noticed, though, that he didn't dare tell the Germans and Austrians or the outside world that he'd already put Schuschnigg under arrest. Such an outrage had not happened before in modern Europe. During this outlandish campaign, you notice this journalist didn't have any trouble putting the adjectives on it. Hitler seemed concerned at some of the points we foreign correspondents had made about his deceit. I don't hear him making that about Saddam, do you? Especially in annexing Austria before the plebiscite took place. In a speech broadcast from Königsberg, he attacked the foreign press and gave a lame, if typical, excuse for his action. Quote, "I have in the course of my political struggle," he said, "won much love from my people. But when I crossed the former frontier into Austria, there met me such a stream of love as I have never experienced. Under the force of this impression, I decided not to wait until April 10th, but to effect the unification forthwith." If you believe that, this journalist said, as I felt sure millions upon millions of Kuwaitis and Palestinians did, then you also believed anything else you were told. We don't get this kind of choose up sides against evil today's media. Hitler wound up his election campaign in Vienna on April 9th on the eve of the polling. I must say he gave one of the most eloquent addresses that I've yet heard from him. But what impressed me most about the speech was that this man, impeccably dressed with a very pretty tie, who once had tramped the pavements of this backwaters, dirty city of Tikrit, and climbed his way up from the dirt by shooting on orders from his uncle, another of his relatives. As a vagabond, unwashed and empty-bellied, radical young painter was speaking as Kaiser Wilhelm II and Emperor Franz Joseph, the last reigning monarchs of the two Germanic empires, is speaking as Nebuchadnezzar the Great, with whom he identifies. See the parallel, by the way. Look at this. Do better than that, quick. Come on. You can do better than that. Louis, get in on that. I'd fly 7,000 miles to smoke a camel. You notice which way the sign is pointing? Kuwait's that way, and the camel's going that way. And look at a close-up on Saddam. I'd fly 7,000 miles to smoke a camel. I warn you.
No, sir.
This man who had once tramped the pavements of this beautiful imperial city as a vagabond, unwashed and empty-bellied, was speaking as if he were in frequent communion with God, whose agent on earth he had become. Quote, "I believe it was God's will to send a youth from here into the Reich, to let him grow up there, to raise him to be the leader of the nation so as to enable him to lead back his homeland into the Reich. There is a higher ordering, and we all are nothing else than its agents. When on March 9th, Herr Schuschnigg broke his agreement, then in that second I felt that now the call of Providence had come to me. And that which then took place in 3 days was only conceivable as the fulfillment of the wish and the will of Providence. I would now give thanks to him who let me return to my homeland, in order that I might now lead it into my German Reich, into the great Arab nation. Tomorrow may every German recognize the hour and measure its import and bow in humility before the Almighty, who in a few weeks has wrought a miracle upon us." Megalomaniac, and Saddam is his imitator. Literally. that a majority of Austrians who undoubtedly would have said ja to Schusnigge on March 13th would say the same to Hitler on April 10th was a foregone conclusion. And so Austria, as Austria, passed for the moment out of history, its very name suppressed by the Austrian who apparently never forgave it for not recognizing his true worth. Vienna just became another city of the Reich, a provincial district administrative center withering away. The former Austrian tramp, now the mighty German dictator, had wiped his native land off the map and deprived its once glittering capital, which he thought had rejected him, of its last shred of glory and importance. Kuwait did not recognize him for what he was, and he swallowed it up. No formal announcement of what happened to Schusnigge was ever made by the German government. So far as I know, the former Austrian chancellor simply disappeared into limbo. Want me to continue? It was also obvious where Hitler would strike next. I noted it down in my diary in Vienna on April 14th, 4 days after Hitler's phony plebiscite. Quote, Czechoslovakia will certainly be next on Hitler's list. Militarily, it is doomed now that Germany, by taking Austria, has flanked it on three sides. You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
Because now we will march to Munich. 1938, all that late summer and early fall of 1938, it looked as if war would come to Europe. Having grabbed his native Austria, Adolf Hitler now turned to his next victim. He began provoking 3 million Palestinians in Saudi Arabia to rebel, promising to come to their aid with all the might of the swiftly flying Scud capital of the world. As the summer progressed, it was feared that the paranoid Fuhrer might attack Czechoslovakia any day. The harassed Czech government under the nation's co-founder, Edward Bernays, was striving to keep it cool despite the hysterical Nazi provocation and what it suspected was British deceit. It was prepared to grant the Sudetenors the autonomy they had asked for. But it was also determined to fight for the nation's survival. Hitler's armies faced her on three sides. Czechoslovakia had a well-armed, well-trained army of 35 divisions deployed behind the most formidable fortifications in Europe outside of France's Maginot Line. It had the assurance that if attacked, France was bound by treaty to come to her aid, and if the French moved, the Soviet Union was obligated to join her in defense of their Czech ally. The Fuhrer's secret order in late spring to wipe Czechoslovakia off the map by October 1st began to be evident as the summer wore on. As the 3 million Sudeten Germans who lived on the frontiers of Bohemia and Moravia and who had received arms and some military training from Himmler's SS began at Berlin's instigation a virtual civil war against the government in Prague, the Fuhrer's insistence with increasing vehemence that the Sudetenors and their territory be handed over to the Reich began to get more strident. And with that, we marched to Munich. By the way, Saddam Hussein set up his secret police force on the pattern of the KGB with their help. New York City, you're coming in loud and clear in Manhattan on 9785 shortwave radio. You can listen to us every night from 8 p.m. to midnight, 7 days a week on shortwave radio. In various places of the United States and certainly in the eastern part and all over the Caribbean, you can pick us up on that marvelous AM station, Clear Channel 1610, off the Isle of Anguilla, British West Indies. I'm reading The Nightmare Years, William L. Scherer. The Fuhrer's secret order in late spring to wipe Czechoslovakia off the map by October 1st began to be evident as the summer wore on. As the 3 million Sudeten Germans who lived in the frontiers of Bohemia and Moravia and who had received arms and some military training from Himmler's SS began at Berlin's instigation, a virtual civil war against the government in Prague, the Fuhrer insisted with increasing vehemence that the Sudetenaires and their territory be handed over to the Reich. To cede this land would destroy Czechoslovakia. As Saddam insisted that they hand over the northern oil fields and part of their port area on the Persian Gulf, follow the parallels. To cede this land would destroy Czechoslovakia, depriving it not only of its mine. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Because I want to take us to Munich tonight. I said earlier, I assume everyone knows about Chamberlain and Munich, but just in case. To cede this land would destroy Czechoslovakia, depriving it not only of its mining and industrial base and of a vital part of its transportation and communications complex, but of its formidable fortress line, without which it could not be defended against the Germans. Nevertheless, in June, I heard that Prime Minister Chamberlain had decided to support Hitler's claim to take over Sudetenland. In May, Chamberlain had spoken off the record to a group of American correspondents at a luncheon at Lady Astor's and frankly told them that Britain favored, quote, in the interest of peace, turning over the Sudetenland to Germany. He had added that in his opinion, neither France nor probably Russia would honor their treaty commitments to aid the Czechs in case of German attack, and that Britain would certainly not get herself involved. The Times of London began to publish that summer its first leaders, urging the Czech government to grant self-determination to the Sudeteners and its other minorities, quote, even if it should mean their secession from Czechoslovakia. The grapevine in London had it that the Times leaders were inspired by the Prime Minister himself. And my information from Germany, or from Berlin, was that the Germans knew it. It was no surprise then, at the beginning of August, Hitler began to provoke a new crisis over the Sudeten Germans. On the 3rd, I flew up to Prague to cover it. In the days that now seem distant, a threat of aggression by a power such as Germany would have brought the Council of the League of Nations in Geneva into special session to try to prevent it. But the League's failure to prevent Japan from overrunning Manchuria and Mussolini from attacking Abyssinia had doomed it. Those who do not know history must forever suffer its repetition. Now, not even France, once the pillar of the League, bothered to ask it to intervene to halt Hitler. Nor did Czechoslovakia, whose president, Beneš, also had been a pillar of the League. It was now every country for itself. Let's worry about jobs at home. Let's solve the problems in our own nation. The League of Nations, that great dream of President Wilson and of millions of others who believed that it would at last prevent aggression and bring lasting peace with justice to mankind, was, one had to face it, dead. But thanks to God's control over history, there's another chance being offered. And Bush stands as he gave his State of the Union address in the position to make it happen. And I believe he's going to. He can only be compared at this moment of history with Wilson and Roosevelt and the opportunities for America to once again lead the world, which has always been its God-ordained destiny. My chief task those first days in Prague was to cover the so-called Runciman mission, which Chamberlain, Prime Minister of Britain, with more deceit than his own public probably was aware of, had dispatched to Czechoslovakia to mediate between the government and the Sudeten Germans. The deception of the British Prime Minister, I soon learned, had begun with his statement to the House of Commons on July 26 about the Runciman mission. Chamberlain said he was sending Lord Runciman to Prague, quote, in response to a request from the government of Czechoslovakia. I like this journalist. This was a lie. The truth was that Runciman had been forced on the Czechs by Chamberlain. He had warned Benes himself through the British minister in Prague, Sir Basil Newton, that if the Runciman mission were not immediately accepted, dire consequences would result. Though shocked by the British proposal, the president finally agreed to it, probably because France, the supposed ally, had pressed him to do so. Benes, I began to suspect, was losing faith in the French and in the value of their treaty obligations to help defend his country against German aggression. I suspected also that he already had given up on the British, though he was an experienced enough diplomat, to play along with them, if only because he realized that Chamberlain was becoming the key figure in the diplomatic maneuvers that would determine his country's fate. Viscount Runciman must have been, or seemed, to Benes, a rather incredible figure to suddenly appear on behalf of the British government. A shipping magnate, former president of the Board of Trade, he had no experience in foreign affairs, no knowledge of them either. Like Perot, to those who have heard him. Judging by his remarks and demeanor, he viewed Kuwait as some out-of-the-way place to which stout Britishers journeyed only in the line of duty to king and country. He viewed Central Europe as some out-of-the-way place to which stout Britishers journeyed only in the line of duty to king and country. In truth, Runciman's negotiations with the Czech government and the Sudeteners were a hoax, since the Sudeten leaders, to whom he took a great personal liking and for whom he asked for more and more concessions from Benes, were not free to negotiate. By this time, they had become good Nazis, and they were taking their orders from Saddam and Baghdad. In Baghdad, where I stopped on my way home, Saddam seemed in a belligerent mood. On August 26, I watched him closely as he reviewed a big military parade he was putting on for the visiting Hungarian regent, Admiral Nicholas Horthy, but in reality, to impress Britain, France, Russia, and Czechoslovakia with Germany's new military might. When at one point, large trucks appeared hauling in an enormous Scud missile, the biggest piece of mobile. When at one point tractors appeared hauling an enormous field gun, the biggest piece of mobile artillery I had ever seen, Hitler turned to watch the reaction of the foreign military attachés. Most of the time in the reviewing stand, he was surly. And party leaders told me he had been in an ugly mood, brooding about the despised Czechs. The dictator was unpredictable, especially when he was in a megalomaniacal mood, as he now seemed to be. In such a stew, he might do anything. I also realized the mood of the German people would not necessarily hold him back. He made the vital decisions. The German people obeyed. But not all the German generals. In fact, though I had no inkling of it, nor I am certain did Adolf Hitler, a conspiracy was afoot to overthrow him, led by no less a figure than the new chief of the Army General Staff, the key military post that once had been occupied in Germany by the great Moltke and Schlieffen. This was General Franz Halder, who had succeeded General Ludwig Beck in August. The gifted Beck had failed to convince Hitler that to go to war before the army was ready would lead to disaster and had resigned. Saddam learned from that. He just executes them. Pro-Nazi, even before Hitler took power, General Beck had gradually seen the light. By 1938, he opposed his chief not only on military grounds, but because he had finally realized that the Nazi regime was a brutal, mindless tyranny that doomed Germany to destruction. His hand-picked successor, Halder, shared these ideas. Michel Aflak, the ideologue, studied these happenings, as has Saddam, which is why he's been known to pull his pistol out and shoot one at the table while they're having a meeting for disagreeing with him. Halder, 54, was the first Bavarian and the first Roman Catholic ever to become chief of the general staff, a severe break with the old Protestant Prussian tradition. Also, like Beck, he did not look like a typical arrogant ramrod, bemonocled old Prussian officer. Rather gentle in manner, he struck me the first time I met him as resembling more a university professor of mathematics or physics. Now, as chief of the general staff, he not only was responsible for planning the assault on Czechoslovakia, but had become the key figure in the first serious plot to overthrow the dictator of the Third Reich. Of that plot, I learned only at the Nuremberg trial that began in November 1945. There, Halder himself testified, as did some of the other surviving figures involved. The story, briefly, was this. A small number of army generals and colonels in cahoots with a few civilians, the most prominent of whom were Dr. Schott, now fallen from grace and resenting it. It's really Dr. Scott, because it's pronounced with the harsh sound, but spelled S-C-H-A-C-H-T. And Karl Gordelier, former mayor of Leipzig, planned to remove Hitler from power if he gave the order to attack Czechoslovakia. Their object was to prevent the mad dictator from plunging Germany into a war which they were sure would bring Britain, France, and Russia in against it and would be lost. A few of the conspirators were genuinely concerned to depose Hitler, not only to save the fatherland from a lost war, but because they had come to view the Nazi regime as criminal folly. Now, Saddam knows all this history, and he will be alert to it. Only the army, it was recognized, possessed the physical power to overthrow the Fuhrer, protected as he was by the considerable forces of the police, the SS, and the SA. General Halder himself, as General Staff Chief, had no actual troops under his command. General Walter von Brockicht, Commander-in-Chief of the Army, disposed of all the forces needed, but Halder did not trust him. The General Staff Chief therefore lined up a few trusted key generals who had troops at their disposal, especially at the most important strategic centers. I will skip through the coup story. They were discouraged from doing it by Chamberlain in Britain. Because in desperation, the conspirators resorted to using the German Foreign Office and the embassy in London in a last effort to persuade the British to stand up to Hitler. They acted through Erich Kort, chief of the Foreign Office Secretariat, and his older brother, counselor of the embassy and charge d'affaires in London, both of whom were in on the conspiracy. After consultations with Generals Beck and Halder, Kort relayed instructions to his brother Theodore in London to give a final secret warning to the British Foreign Secretary himself. This he did on the morning of September 7th after being spirited through a back door of the Foreign Office to the chambers of Lord Halifax. To that aristocrat, the second most important man in the British government, Kort reiterated that Hitler had ordered an attack on Czechoslovakia to begin on October 1st at the latest, but that if Britain and France held firm against him, the German army was prepared to overthrow the dictator the moment the final order to attack was given. He could have been stopped. He urged the British government to broadcast a final warning to Hitler, saying bluntly what it would do in case of German aggression. For a few days, Chamberlain considered giving such a warning. He was acutely aware of the consequences of the failure of the British government to give Berlin such notice in the summer of 1914, so history was repeating itself again. But he was talked out of taking such a step by his ambassador in Berlin, Henderson, who by this time was clamoring for the prime minister to give Hitler what he wanted in Czechoslovakia. Instead of issuing the warning as the German conspirators had urged, Chamberlain decided on another tack. On the 10th, Prague was calm but apprehensive. On the 5th, President Beneš, in a last desperate effort to save the peace, had called in the Sudeten negotiators and told them to write out their full demands. Whatever they were, he would accept them. "My God," the deputy's Sudeten leader, Karl Hermann Frank, exclaimed to some of the correspondents the next day, "they've given us everything." But that was the last thing Hitler wanted. The Sudeten Germans had been all along a pawn to conceal his real goal of destroying Czechoslovakia. On September 7th, he ordered Heinlein, the Sudeten leader, to break off all negotiations with the Czechs. A shabby excuse about alleged Czech police excesses at Moravská Ostrava was invented. Notice he doesn't mind using adjectives. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
On the 10th, the day of my arrival, you can put Chamberlain's name on a lot of voices you've heard for a long time in this country. On the 10th, the day of my arrival, Beneš broadcast to the world an appeal for calm and for peace. In Nuremberg, the bellicose Göring answered him. Beneš was sure, he said, that the crises could be resolved with reason, goodwill, and mutual trust on both sides. Running to the president in the hall of Broadcasting House when he had finished, I wanted to rush up and say, "But Mr. President," this is the journalist, "I wanted to rush up and say, but Mr. President, you are dealing with gangsters, with Hitler and Göring. You think they are capable of reason, goodwill, and trust?" He didn't have any more evidence for that viewpoint that he didn't mind speaking, even to this president, than all the newsmen reporting in the Gulf and about the Gulf have on Saddam Hussein, Hitler's imitator. As for Göring's speech at Nuremberg that same evening, quote, "A petty segment of Europe is harassing human beings. This miserable pygmy race, the Czechs, without a culture, no one knows where it came from, is oppressing a cultured people. The Arabs, the Sudeten Germans, and behind it is Moscow, the United States, and the eternal mask of the Jew devil." Next day, the 11th, you could cut the tension in Prague with a knife. Rumors filled the air. One was that Germans had massed 200,000 troops on the old Austro-Czech frontier. London reported continuous conferences in Downing Street. In Paris, Premier Daladier conferred anxiously with General Gamelin, commander-in-chief of the French armed forces. Everyone in Europe, it seemed, was anxiously awaiting Hitler's speech on the morrow. Peter Arnett was going to record it. My diary that day ended, quote, CBS finally okays a 5-minute daily report from here, but asked me to cable beforehand when I think the news does not warrant my taking the time. My God, he says, here was the old continent on the brink of war. Hitler might start it within 24 hours. Prague might be wiped off the map overnight by the big bombers, and the network was most reluctant to provide 5 minutes a day from here to report it. To the surprise and relief of almost everyone in Europe, Hitler the next day, September 12th, held back from war. In his speech to an audience of delirious brown shirts on the final evening of the Nuremberg party rally, he thundered against the Czechs, their nation, their president, their brutal oppression of the Sudeten Germans. But he stopped short of declaring war. I listened to the broadcast of the speech in the apartment of Bill Morrill of the London Daily Express. Though I had covered 2 annual party congresses at Nuremberg, I'd never heard Hitler's voice so crackling with venom and spite, or heard this particular audience of party faithfuls quite so hysterical in bedlam. He seemed to spew out poison as he assaulted and insulted the Czechs, and especially President Beneš. But he did not demand, as many had expected, that the Sudetenaires be turned over to him outright, or even after a plebiscite. He did insist, though, on self-determination for them. The relief in Prague, whose streets were deserted all evening because everyone was home listening to Saddam, was immense. They wouldn't even call me that night. I'd spent a good part of the day, which was dark and dismal with a biting rain, roaming through the narrow streets trying to see how people face the imminence of invasion, war, bombing. The next day and night in Prague, September 13th and 14th, I shall never forget. War is very near. I begin wearily in my diary at 3 a.m. on the 14th. Since midnight, waiting for the German bombers, much shooting up in the Sudetenland, the Czechs have declared martial law there. The Sudetenaires have been brought to so near to hysteria by the prodding of Goebbels' propaganda machine that Hitler's speech, relatively restrained, though I thought it had been, had touched off a violent outbreak among them. At 7 that evening, we learned that Hinland had sent the Czech government an ultimatum. It was delivered at 6 p.m. and expired at midnight. By that hour, it said the Czech government must repeal martial law, withdraw all state police from the Sudetenland, and confine all troops to their barracks. Otherwise, all negotiations were off, and the Czechs would be responsible for further developments. Since Hinland was taking his orders directly from Hitler, we concluded that the ultimatum was backed by the Führer. The further developments threatened by Hinland surely meant war. At that time, remember, the good people of Europe had had no experience of war for 20 years. Even in the Great War, murderous as it was, cities and homes outside the combat areas had been spared. Now, for the first time, they suddenly faced, in Prague, we believe we faced it this very night, a kind of war never before experienced by mankind. Immediate bombing from the air that would overnight obliterate the cities and the homes and lives of many. Some of the bombs people feared might spew poison gas. History repeats itself, doesn't it? I'm staying past midnight. We'll be leaving the shortwave in some cities. You need to have satellite dish to pick up the rest, or be listening here in Los Angeles and San Francisco and many other cities. get on the telephone, talk to me if you want me to take us all the way to Munich tonight so this track is laid down in history for those that pay attention. I'm reading The Nightmare Years, William Scherer. Scherer. The attack is about to happen as Hitler will move, having swallowed up Austria, into Czechoslovakia. And this is what would have happened to Saudi Arabia had we not acted. I kept making notes that night of how it felt when war came. Later, after some first-hand experience of war, especially of bombing by both sides, first in Berlin and then in London, the remembrance of that hectic night when we awaited Hitler's bombers somewhat paled for me. But as an account of how it felt the first time, it deserves perhaps a few words from among those I hastily jotted down at the moment on the spot. The tension and confusion this night in the lobby of the Rashid Hotel, Ambassador Hotel, where the diplomats and correspondents gather, has been indescribable. Fascinating to watch the reactions of people, suddenly seized with fear. Some can't take it. They let themselves go to a point of hysteria and then in panic flee to God knows where. Most take it with various degrees of courage. In the lobby tonight, the newspaper men milling around trying to get telephone calls through the hotel's one lone operator. Jews excitingly trying to book out on the last plane or train. The wildest rumors coming in with every new person that steps through the revolving door from outside. All of us gathering around to listen, believing or disbelieving according to our feelings. Goering's bombers will come at midnight unless the Czechs accept the ultimatum. They will use gas. How can a man get a gas mask? There are none. What do you do then? Danes will accept the ultimatum. He must. At one point in the evening, an element of comedy breaks the tension. Alex Small, an old friend and colleague of mine from our days on the Paris edition of the Chicago Tribune, is sitting behind a large stein of Pilsen beer, frowning at a cable he's just received. It's from his boss, my old boss, the terrible Colonel McCormick, who owns most of the paper and runs all of it. He has cabled Alex on how to cover the war. Listen to this, boys and girls, Alex calls out, pausing to gulp down a big quaff of his beer. Advice from the colonel. Alex starts to read the message. Wars always start at dawn. Be there at dawn. The chorus of laughs. At last, something to laugh about for a moment. Cable him you're already there, Randall Packard, a rough-necked gem of a guy with a gravelly voice, cries out. More laughs. Toward midnight, when the ultimatum is to expire, we all grow a little apprehensive. We keep checking our watches. Finally, an official from the Czech Foreign Office comes in, his face grave. Turn down, he says in German. The ultimatum is rejected by the government. The correspondents fly to the telephone booth. Several Jews scurry out. The press agent of the Sudeten German party, a big jovial fellow who usually drops in to give us his party's news, comes in as usual, but this time he's not jovial. Have they turned it down, he asks. He hardly waits for the answer. Grabbing a small bag, he vanishes through the door. About 2 a.m., I raced up the street to Broadcasting House to do my piece. Out in the street, all was calm. No troops, no police to be seen. Maybe we correspondents got too excited.
Still had a good story, I thought, but it didn't get through. Atmospherics or sunspots, the Czech radio engineers suspected. Next day, I drove 200 miles through the Sudetenland. The Czech army had crushed the Sudeten uprising. Many of the towns were in shambles. Both sides were counting the dead and wounded, which were considerable. I returned in the evening to Prague thinking that Hitler had suffered a serious rebuff. The Sudeten Germans were beaten, and the Nazi dictator had not moved to save them despite all his bellowing. But a headline in the early edition of the morning paper caught me up. Chamberlain to fly to Berchtesgaden tomorrow to see Hitler. The Czechs were dumbfounded. They suspected a sellout, and they were surely right. I broadcast my news soon after midnight, but again did not get through. Next day, September 16th, the Czechs seemed to be sure of it. They believed Hitler asked for and Chamberlain agreed to a plebiscite for the Sudeteners. It probably sounded to the outside world like a reasonable proposal and democratic. But what the prime minister didn't seem to realize, the Czechs feared, was that to cede the Sudetenland was to cede the Czechs' mountain fortress line and therefore their ability to defend themselves from a German attack. I wrote a broadcast saying that the Czechs would fight rather than give in on this point. It was the only way they thought they could survive. I thought it important at this confusing moment to let the American public know this. But I felt frustrated at the thought that my broadcast probably would not get through for the third successive day. CBS had cabled that morning they could not hear me. It was a sickening setback. Radio couldn't get through regularly from Europe to America because of, quote, atmospherics. Then it had little future in the decimation of the news from abroad. Later that night, after my broadcast, I could hear New York perfectly on the feedback. They said they heard me equally well. I felt immensely relieved. I felt better about the news. The Czechs were standing up to Hitler. You notice his bias all the time? Against that evil of Hitler? In Berlin the next day, I found Nazi circles jubilant over the Berchtesgaden meeting. Hitler, they said, had convinced Chamberlain that Czechoslovakia would have to turn over the Sudetenland to Germany. The Foreign Office had sent out a confidential message to its embassies abroad to that effect. Long ago in Berlin, I'd learned to dissemble a little in my reporting, as I did that day in the Capitol by the closing words of my broadcast. One thing is certain, Mr. Chamberlain will certainly get a warm welcome at Gettysburg. In fact, I get the impression in Berlin today that Mr. Chamberlain is a pretty popular figure around here. In other words, which I hoped was understood in America, the British Prime Minister was backing Hitler against Czechoslovakia. Too cold in here, Brad. Turn down a little. This was bad enough, but the propaganda lies about the Czech treatment of the Sudeten Germans, which Goebbels was perpetuating on the German people to whip them into a war fever, made me even more nauseated. The journalist who can take sides. I found the Nazi press, all the press there was in Germany, full of hysterical headlines that were pure and deliberate falsehoods. Some examples. Women and children mowed down by Czech armored cars, bloody regime, new Czech murders of Germans. The esteemed Börsen Zeitung, organ of the financial world, perhaps took the prize. Poison gas attack on Aussie. Extortion, plundering, shooting. Czech terror in Sudeten German land grows worse from day to day. To one who had just come from the Sudetenland, these hysterical inventions of the sick minds of Goebbels, of Assis, and Saddam were revolting. That's taking sides. Why hadn't Chamberlain at least mentioned them to Hitler and branded them for the lies they were? After all, he had had a man on the spot, Runciman. Other newspapers proclaimed in headlines, Czech soldiers attack the German Reich. the usual lies. In Goldsberg, one of the loveliest towns on the Rhine, the drama being acted out by Chamberlain and Hitler, while all of Europe anxiously awaited, continued. Act One had been staged at Berchtesgaden the previous week. Here, where I arrived on Wednesday morning, September 21st, the curtain was going up on Act Two. Hitler had put up at an old hangout of his, the Hotel Driesen. I found him in an ugly and highly nervous mood. I was having breakfast on the terrace of the Driesen overlooking the Rhine with a friend, an Austrian editor of a German magazine who I knew secretly loathed Hitler. Suddenly the dictator appeared, strode past us, and went down to the river's edge to inspect his yacht. My friend nudged me. Look at his walk. I'd already noticed it. Every few steps, Hitler cocked his right shoulder nervously, his left leg snapping up as he did so. I watched him closely as he came back past us, the same nervous tick. He had ugly black patches under his eyes. I thought to myself, this man's on the edge of a nervous breakdown. Then I understood the meaning of an expression I'd heard from some party hacks close to him since my return to Germany. They kept talking about the tepid presser, the carpet chewer. At first, I not got it, and then someone had whispered to me. The Fuhrer, he said, had been suffering one of his worst nervous crises, and it had taken a strange form. Whenever he went on a rampage about the Czechs or Bernays, as he'd been doing almost daily, for more than a week, he'd fling himself to the floor and chew the edge of the carpet. I'd been skeptical of the story, but after this morning on the Rhine Terrace, I could believe it. Neville Chamberlain also seemed to me to be a little nervous and solemn, though less so than the German leader when he landed at the Cologne airport about noon and emerged from the plane scowling, clasping his umbrella, though the sun was out. Opposition to his appeasement of Hitler at the expense of Czechoslovakia, I knew, was growing in Parliament and in the press. However, he seemed to regain some of his jauntiness as he drove to Gettysburg, whose streets were decorated with the Union Jack, as well as a swastika, and up to his deluxe hotel on the east bank of the Rhine across from Gettysburg. Despite his mien, Chamberlain was in an optimistic mood. Members of his delegation stressed this as they set off. After all, he was bringing the raging Fuhrer everything he'd asked for at Berchtesgaden. Agreement of the Czechs extracted from them by Britain and France to cede Sudetenland to Germany. A few days later, after he had accomplished his... well, let's read before this. Do I understand, asked Hitler, that the British, French, and Czech governments have agreed to the transfer of the Sudetenland from Czechoslovakia to Germany? Yes, replied Chamberlain, beaming. I am terribly sorry, Hitler said, but after the events of the last few days, this plan is no longer of any use. Dr. Paul Schmidt, Hitler's interpreter, remembered later that Chamberlain sat up with a start, his owl-like face flushed with surprise and anger. But apparently the prime minister still could not face the reality that Adolf Hitler, like a common blackmailer, was upping his demands at the very moment they were being accepted. A few days later, Chamberlain told the Commons, I do not want the House to think that Hitler was deliberately deceiving me. I do not think so for one minute. But for me, I expected that when I got back to Gettysburg, I had only to discuss quietly with him the proposals that I'd brought with me, and it was a profound shock to me when I was told that these proposals were not acceptable. Seeing his plans for peace at the expense of the Czechs collapse like a house of cards, Chamberlain did summon up enough courage to reply to Hitler. He was both disappointed and puzzled, he said. He could rightly say that the Fuhrer had got from him what he had demanded. The two men, I must say, did not look as if they'd had a falling out when they emerged from their three-hour meeting. Just as I was about to broadcast, Hitler and Chamberlain strode by saying their farewells cordially enough. In fact, the Prime Minister seemed highly pleased, in his vain way, at some manufactured applause by a company SS guards before the hotel entrance.
They had scheduled a meeting for the next morning. The next morning it was canceled. The talks had completely broke down. The war seems very near after this strange day, I scribbled in my diary. Chamberlain did not give me the impression he himself felt war was near. Hitler had invited him over for a meeting at 10:30 that Friday evening at the Dresden. I didn't learn much of what transpired until the next day, but it was plain from the gloom among the German officers, military officers in the lobby, that the meeting was going badly. Still, when it broke up at 1:30 a.m. and Hitler and Chamberlain strode by my porter's lodge while I was waiting to go on the air, I noted that neither seemed unduly strained. In fact, it seemed to me they acted surprisingly cordial still. Dr. Schmidt, the official Nazi interpreter, took down the words which I could not actually hear through my glass door. Even this much later, after the lapse of nearly half a century, they astonish. Chamberlain bid a hearty farewell to the Fuhrer. He said he had the feeling that a relationship of confidence had grown up between himself and the Fuhrer as a result of the conversations of the last few days. He did not cease to hope that the present difficult crises would be overcome, and then he would be glad to discuss other problems still outstanding with the Fuhrer in the same spirit. The Fuhrer thanked Chamberlain for his words and told him that he had similar hopes, as he had already stated several times, Hitler said, the Czech problem was the last territorial demand which he had to make in Europe. I was about to go on the air at 2 a.m. when Dr. Goebbels came rushing into my studio, grabbed my notes, excitedly forbade me to say anything except to read the official communique. He wouldn't even let me quote what Chamberlain had said as he returned to his hotel. One of my friends had just phoned it in to me. Is the position hopeless, sir? A British correspondent had asked him. I would not like to say that, the Prime Minister answered. It is up to the Czechs now. That's just what Hitler wanted, to shift responsibility on the Czechs. At 2:30, I stumbled out of the Dresden drained. Just before leaving, overheard Goebbels say that according to the Czech radio, President Beneš had ordered general mobilization. It means war. That news cheered me up a little. It showed the Czechs would fight, despite all the belligerence of Hitler, Goebbels, Ribbentrop, and the Nazi press and radio. I was not sure that the Germans wanted to fight. The German people, so far as I could tell, expected Hitler to get what he wanted without having to go to war. I staggered down the street, bleary-eyed with fatigue, to my hotel. A few more personal notes in this record, because I got to go quickly to two more pages in this half hour. What impressed the Germans the most was the British Prime Minister's agreement to transmit Hitler's demands to Prague. This showed they were sure that Chamberlain was backing Hitler. The Nazi press that weekend took up a new propaganda cry with Hitler and Chamberlain for peace. The next day, the optimism in Berlin vanished. It became known that the Czech government had rejected Hitler's Gettysburg demands, that France had found them unacceptable, and over the weekend had ordered partial mobilization, and that as a result, the Fuhrer was in one of the worst rages of his tumultuous life. He vented it at a speech at the Sports Palace that very evening, shouting and shrieking in the worst fit I had ever seen him in. He hurled a torrent of insults against Herr Beneš, denouncing him as the father of lies. Trying to work up his audience of 15,000 party members into a suitable state for war, he grimly depicted the Sudetenland as under a Czech reign of terror, where whole stretches of the country were depopulated, villages burned down, and attempts made to smoke out Germans with hand grenades and poison gas. He was repeating the by now stale propaganda lies. And I noticed, as the Fuhrer raved on, that despite the crowds hanging on to every venomous word, there was no war fever. He ended up his speech saying, it's now up to Herr Beneš. He has the choice, peace or war. Then he sank in his chair, exhausted after the speech. special British envoy telephoned London after Hitler's speech, urging that he not deliver to the Chancellor Chamberlain's warning that Britain would support France if she were drawn into war over Czechoslovakia. Chamberlain insisted he deliver it more in sorrow than anger. The Prime Minister, inept as he was in dealing with Hitler, apparently had an eye on history, remembering that if Sir Edward Grey had warned Berlin in 1914 that Britain would support France, the Kaiser might never have gone to war. "I will smash Czechoslovakia," Hitler screamed out. I get over to the next stage. Chamberlain then began negotiating. One more meeting. Just one more meeting. So Hitler finally agreed that he would have one more meeting. And in that meeting, Chamberlain would show up, Mussolini would show up, Beneš would show up, and Chamberlain made clear his resolve to continue his effort. He said, "I would not hesitate to pay even a third visit to Germany if I thought it would do any good." And Chamberlain's further statement was that if we British have to fight, it must be on larger issues than a quarrel in a faraway country between people of whom we know nothing. Sound familiar?
Yes, sir.
They met. The ultimatum had expired, but at the instigation of Mussolini and frantically urged on by Chamberlain, Hitler postponed his attack on Czechoslovakia. Here's the meeting I referenced. And agreed to meet with Mussolini, Chamberlain, and Daladier of France on the morrow. Beneš was not there. At Munich, I said Beneš earlier, he wasn't invited, which is all the more ridiculous. The one that they all met over Czechoslovakia and didn't invite Beneš. To settle the details of Germany's takeover of the Sudetenland. In the Wilhelmstrasse, indeed all of Germany, there was immense relief at the news. Greater even in Paris and London. The scene in the House of Commons, listen to this, that afternoon released pent-up feelings in Britain in the display of mass hysteria seldom witnessed on that chilly island. People must have flooded into the streets and said, "Our protests have saved the day. We're not going to war." It had convened with the feeling among most members, some of them subsequently told me, that war was inevitable. By 4:15, Chamberlain had been addressing the body for about an hour and 20 minutes, defending his appeasement of Hitler and praising Mussolini for having a few hours before persuaded Hitler to postpone his mobilization for 24 hours. He paused to glance at a note which was handed to him as he spoke. He looked up and smiled. Listen to this. "And that's not all." He'd just been handed the note. "I have something further to say to the House. I have now been informed by Herr Hitler that he invites me to meet him at Munich tomorrow morning. He has also invited Signor Mussolini and Monsieur Daladier. Signor Mussolini has accepted, and I have no doubt Monsieur Daladier will accept. I need not say what my answer will be." He didn't have to say. That ancient chamber burst out in a wild cry such as had never been heard in it. The honorable members shouted their joy at the top of their voices, hurled order papers into the air. A few sobbed. Some broke into tears. Above the tumult, a shout was heard that seemed to express the deep feelings of all. Thank God for the Prime Minister. Now, of course, there wouldn't be war. What of the Halder plot to dispose of Hitler? Already told you, with peace at hand, Chamberlain and the British advised him to drop it. The hastily called conference the next day was anticlimactic. The sorry spectacle it presented to France and Britain, selling out the only democracy in Central Europe, the loyal ally of the French, and giving Hitler the greatest diplomatic triumph of his life, depressed me beyond words. Once I grasped what Hitler, Chamberlain, Mussolini, and Daladier were up to, I felt too wretched to try adequately to report on their antics. A lapse that contributed to my being badly scooped by my arch rival on the radio NBC. As they gave the Sudetenland away, Chamberlain raised the question in the conference, what about the Czechs not being allowed even to take their cattle out of the Sudetenland with them? Chamberlain asked. At this, Hitler exploded. Our time is too valuable, he shouted to Chamberlain, to be wasted on such trivialities. The Prime Minister gave in. 7 p.m., the Big Four agreed the Germans would begin occupying the Sudetenland on October 1st. 30 minutes after midnight, the translations of the Munich Accord were finally finished. A notable victory for Hitler. Mussolini looked cocky as a rooster as he left. Daladier, I noted in my diary, looked completely beaten and broken. Chamberlain, in contrast to his French colleague, looked exceedingly pleased with himself. I was exhausted and depressed for the long day. I didn't feel much better the next morning when I learned Chamberlain, behind the back of Daladier, had gone to see Hitler at the latter's private apartment and induced him to sign a joint statement that the Prime Minister must have thought with reason would, so far as British public opinion was concerned, take the sting or some of it out of his sellout of Czechoslovakia the night before. It would also appeal to the deep pacifism of the British people. We, Chamberlain pulled out of his pocket the statement and asked Hitler to join him in signing it. We regard the agreement signed last night in the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again. We are resolved that the method of consultation should be the method to deal with other questions that may concern our two countries, and we're determined to continue our efforts to remove possible sources of differences and thus contribute to the peace of Europe. The surrender to Hitler at Munich was not necessary. That was the last chance to stop him. Winston Churchill later summed it up as he led the people back up to victory. The year's breathing space said to be gained by Munich left Britain and France in a much worse position compared to Hitler's Germany than they'd been at the Munich crisis. Thank God we didn't do it this time. Now, I did hate in that last half hour to rush through that sellout by Chamberlain, peace at all costs. His surrender. Well, I'm going to read a little more now that we're into another half hour. The statement that Chamberlain went to Hitler to get signed, I read again. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement is symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again. We are resolved that the method of consultation shall be the method to deal with other questions that may concern our two countries, and we are determined to continue our efforts to remove possible sources of difference and thus to contribute to the peace of Europe. Dr. Smith's impression, the translator, was that Hitler signed the paper with a certain reluctance only to please Chamberlain, who he recounts thanked the Fuhrer warmly and underlined the great psychological effect which he expected from this document. Indeed, the Prime Minister played it for all it was worth. And some of you have seen old news pictures showing Chamberlain coming down the steps of the plane waving the paper, brandishing it in his hands as he addressed the happy crowd from a window at 10 Downing Street on his return that evening, he declared, "My good friends, this is the second time in our history that there has come back from Germany to Downing Street peace with honor. I believe it is peace in our time." The British press, Parliament, and the people were jubilant, hailing the returning Prime Minister as a hero. The Times wrote that no conqueror returning from the battlefield has come adorned with nobler laurels. Only Duff Cooper, the First Lord of the Admiralty, resigned from the Cabinet in protest. And when in the ensuing House of Commons debate, Churchill rose to brand Munich as a total unmitigated defeat, he was forced to pause until a storm of hostile shouting had subsided. The House backed Chamberlain. By a resounding vote of 366 to 144. The Germans, too, were happy. The Fuhrer had won another bloodless victory. The third since he had gone into the demilitarized Rhineland and then taken Austria. He had increased his prestige with the people. He had won further ascendancy over the army. Ironically enough, he himself was far from satisfied by his triumph over the West. The immediate aftermath of Munich was to me as shabby and deceitful as the conference itself. The International Commission in Berlin was a farce. It sided with the Germans in every dispute over territory and in the final limiting of frontiers. It never honored the Munich Pledge to carry out plebiscites in an area where the makeup of the population was in doubt. Germany and Italy never honored their words to guarantee, once the question of Polish and Hungarian minorities was settled, what was left of Czechoslovakia against aggression. Britain and France, for their part, declined when aggression occurred to honor the guarantee they solemnly had given at Munich. Such was Chamberlain's peace with honor. Not much later. Early in the spring that year, Hitler struck again. At dawn on March 15, 1939, he sent in his troops to occupy the rest of Czechoslovakia, and as he had threatened to do, wiped it off the map. The splendid little democracy, the only one left in Central and Eastern Europe, ceased to exist. I should have rushed to Prague to report it firsthand, but I was too depressed. I haven't the heart, I confessed in my diary in Geneva. That's why Bob Michaels, the minority leader, stood and gave that moving speech, having and said, there are those in this body old enough who served in the Second World War and remember Chamberlain and Munich. The appetite of a megalomaniac fascist dictator, as Hitler was and as Saddam Hussein is, can never be satisfied by appeasement. Do you have any idea how many hundreds of thousands of lives lost in the Second World War when they finally recognized that Hitler would not quit until he had it all? Were lost on the Russian front, on the beaches of Normandy, across Northwest Europe, the bombings in Britain. How many hundreds of thousands of lives had been lost if Churchill had been the Prime Minister and not Chamberlain? And if the people had stood up when he first went into Austria. The head of state in Austria left somewhat to be desired. But to let Hitler take it the way he did started an inevitable path of deceit and treachery and brutal aggression that could only be stopped when America rose up, as it did in the First World War against the Kaiser, assumed its responsibility to the world, fought back the isolationists, and defeated this perpetrator of the Holocaust and the Blitzkrieg and the oppression of Europe and the attempt to conquer it all. That's why waiting would do no good. There are those that said, well, it's not like Munich, because the world community has put a blockade on Saddam. Anybody with a brain in their head knows that what Winston Churchill said was true. The coalition would have eroded. The opportunity to move with the moral force and unity that now exists would have dissolved. The will of the people would have been broken down through the power of the media to accentuate the minority's view, peace at all cost. And they did what they knew they had to do. And they're doing it well. And I agree with Bush. Those that are over there are worth more than all of Iraq. And I'd fly 7,000 miles to smoke a camel. I think it's time to play. Let's see how fast the camels can run. Hank's song. Don't play it yet. I got one more comment. Now, I deliberately wanted to lay this synopsis down tonight and not stretch it into two nights. You that have listened and have seen the parallels and had your resolve strengthened, you need to write letters. Don't stop writing them. I got a message tonight where the Times said they had received 3,000 plus letters against the war and 1,700 for it.
Yeah.
Well, you all can change that in 2 days. Get your letter writing pen out. But at the same time, do your job here to keep this voice going.
Yeah.
Fullerton, I'm from Czechoslovakia. I was there when the occupation took place. It is very similar to what's happening now. And Washington, D.C., my father, who is stationed somewhere south of Riyadh, is sending this message to Dr. Scott. Dr. Scott's messages are being heard with the soldiers. There's been a positive response to what is being said. We appreciate these messages. Come on, let's get Secret 5 done. Get on the telephone. I'm going to give you one more quick similarity. In a broadcast from London on April 23rd, still reading The Nightmare Years, William L. Scherer, I tried to sum up the aims of Nazi Germany and how the German people felt about them and Hitler. I had to keep in mind that whatever I said abroad about the Third Reich and its impetuous leaders quickly got back to Berlin, and that if Hitler and Goebbels disapproved too strongly, they might not let me return. Sound familiar? In that case, my somewhat long career of covering Nazi Germany would be terminated, something I wanted to avoid if I honorably and decently could. Since this was the biggest and most important continuing story there was in the world, on its outcome depended whether there could be peace or war. By this time, I had learned what all correspondents became aware of after working in totalitarian lands, that you could say a great deal if you were not too careless in how you said it. This talk from London, over which I had given much thought all that spring,
expressed accurately my thinking on the subject. I could not have broadcast it from Berlin. I could from London and hope to get away with it. The German people, I said, believed in a number of things. Believed. Most or all of which might surprise Americans. One, that Great Britain, backed by France and Soviet Union and the United States, was forging an encirclement of Germany designed to crush it. Sound familiar? This is what the people believed. They had singular press. Two, that in view of the German experience in the Great War, Hitler was right to attempt to break that encirclement before it was completed. Three, that Eastern and Southeastern Europe were a natural part of Germany's Lebensraum, literally living space, the domination of which was necessary for it, Germany's existence, and that neither Britain nor any other country, including America, had any right to interfere with Germany's action there. This is an air problem. Four, that Hitler would get what he wanted in Eastern Europe and get it as he got Austria and Czechoslovakia without a war. And that's what Saddam thought. Five, that there would therefore be no war and that they, the German people, at any rate, did not want war. War could only come if the encirclement powers, jealous of Germany's success, attacked the Reich, in which case they would gladly fight and this time would win. Six, that Hitler had outsmarted the foreign tyrants who were trying to keep Germany down and that he had restored it to its proper place in the world. All Saddam wants is respect. And done it without a single shot being fired nor the life of one German soldier sacrificed. I ventured to comment on Nazi Germany's goal. Neither Germans nor foreigners in Berlin believe for one second that Hitler will stop now. The goal is the domination of Eastern Europe down to the Black Sea. If it reaches it, Germany will not only be the most powerful country in Europe, but it will be invulnerable to the blockade which lost it the last war. The raw materials and food so necessary for its existence will be available in its own backyard. Sound familiar?
Yes, sir.
It's happening again. Thank God we're stopping it. And all the media wants to talk about is why are 90 planes going to Iran? What if Iran got in a war? We're going to have to go there and conquer them, just bomb the hell out of them there. What if Jordan gets in the war? Israel will take care of them. And the Patriot missiles will move right over there, very close to where they're shooting them off. By the way, did you notice in that newscast of the film by Arnett in Baghdad, of the skyline with the sirens going off and the planes flying over, didn't look nearly like the fireworks of the first night. There's something missing. There ain't as much shooting up going on. And every time we've met their tanks, we wiped the whole line of them out today and lost nothing. Every time we've met the boats, we've sunk them. When they turn the oil on, we turn it off. They fire artillery shells, and we wipe their artillery out. And you will find, yes, there will be losses, but when we go on the ground, the technical superiority will be demonstrated just as much there as it is in the air. We have guns that can shoot the lice off of them. Fear-mongering press are not even in this century.
They've been looking at themselves for so long in monitors and reading idiot cards instead of history. They don't even know what's going on. So resist it. Get your letters out. Write. If there's a pro-war protest, go join them. Wave your flags. Write the media, write the president, and tell him you got a pastor that says keep kicking his ass.